This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The celebrated films Chariots of Fire, Gandhi, Local Hero, and The Killing Fields were produced by the independent company Goldcrest Films. So were the box office bombs Revolution and Absolute Beginners. The company was founded in 1977 by Canadian financier Jake Eberts. He's co-authored a new book on the rise and fall of Goldcrest called My Indecision is Final. The collapse of Goldcrest was attributed in part to mismanagement after Eberts left the company over conflicts with another executive. In 1985, Eberts founded the company Allied Filmmakers, which produced Driving Miss Daisy, Texas Phil, and Kevin Costner's new film Dances with Wolves. Eberts lives most of the year in London, but he's currently in the States. We invited him to talk with us about the ins and outs of the business of film, such as what a company like his does.
Well, it does everything that a major studio does, except it doesn't distribute films. It develops films. It acquires rights to books. It gets ideas from filmmakers and turns those ideas into scripts. It gets projects ready so that they can be financed, so that we have a cast and a script and a director and a budget. Then we take that project, that package, to a major studio in the U.S. to get them to put up money to distribute the film in the U.S. market. As an example, on our most recent film, which is coming out in 10 days' time, Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, Kevin had been working on that idea for a number of years. He had developed a screenplay based on a book which he had also worked on. And we got involved and put up about $500,000 to get the production going and get the budget written, get the final screenplay drafted, to prepare the whole package. We then took it to a number of studios, and Orion Pictures put in about $10 million, and we put up another $7.5 million, or almost $8 million. And with that $18 million, we said, "Okay, Kevin, off you go to South Dakota and start shooting." So that's the role of the film financier. It's a combination of picking projects, picking directors, picking writers, knowing how the various markets around the world look at projects and therefore how much they'll pay for those projects. Generally speaking, getting involved up to the time shooting starts and then standing back while the director and the crew make the film and then stepping back in once the film is finished shooting and we then start to work on the edit and the music and finally start to work on the marketing, which is generally speaking about 6 or 8 months after shooting starts.
So one of the most important decisions you make is which films to back. Because if you back a loser, you're going to lose a lot of money. If you back a film that goes well at the box office, then you'll be very successful. Do you have criteria for making a decision like that? And I don't mean, you know, empirical criteria, but is it because you like a film that you'll say, let's produce it, or because you see box office possibilities in it?
I think there are two or three general rules which I tend to follow. Number one, I usually only get involved with a major filmmaker or with someone who's clearly got a overwhelming passion to make his film. That means either a director who has made several good or successful films. Good is not always the same as successful, because you can have a very good film which doesn't make money. But generally speaking, a director who's proven he really knows how to direct a film, number one. Number two, I only do it if I have a story or a script which I really like. It takes so much effort and so much time and so much devotion to the people involved that unless you feel this tremendous interest yourself, it just is impossible to generate the kind of enthusiasm and energy and effort that you need to get the whole thing done. So number two, I have to personally really like the story. And I think number three, I like to feel that the films we're making are suitable for my kids and my mother, so they have to appeal to the broadest possible demographic range from 11 years old and up to 78 years old. And that almost always means a film which is rooted in some sort of value system, which means it's it means something. It has more than just an action story or a brief topical story. It's a story which I think can last and can be reshown in 5 years' time or 10 years' time and still have the same impact as it would now.
Can I ask you for an example of one of the best and one of the worst choices you made in selecting a movie?
I can't give one of the best. I'll have to plead and say, let me give you two or three of the best and two or three of the worst.
Okay.
Certainly among the best would be Chariots of Fire, which we made in 1981. Gandhi, which we made in 82. Killing Fields, which we made in 83. Those, I think, are among the best. Driving Miss Daisy, which we made about 18 months ago. All those films have the same ingredients which I mentioned earlier: a great filmmaker attached, either as director or producer, a story which I felt I really wanted to see made. And I think all those films can be looked at in 5 or 10 years' time and have the same impact and have the same meaning and perhaps give the same kind of enjoyment as they did when they first came out. Among the worst films which I ever got involved in, one was called Zulu Dawn, which I did in the late 70s, where I, for the first and last time, put up my own money, which was an awful mistake, which I lost all of. The film was not made by a good filmmaker. I wasn't deeply involved with the story. I did it for all the wrong reasons. I did it to make money, which I didn't. I lost money on it. So that would certainly have to be up there amongst the worst films I got involved in. Going on from there, I guess I'd have to choose a film called An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, which was a small film I made for all the wrong reasons in 1981. Again, the deal was a good deal, but the film was a terrible film. The deal was good because we had some tax benefits, and the minute you start making films because the deal is good, you're probably guaranteeing that you're going to lose money, and I did, at least our company did. Moving on swiftly, this is painful. It's hard to choose the worst. I guess I can say we made two bad films and hopefully many more good ones, but those two stick out in my mind as bad mistakes, and now that I know why I made them, I can look back and say I made them for the wrong reasons and hope I never do that sort of thing again. I'm too old for it.
You say when you make a movie because the deal sounds good, the movie almost always goes bad. I don't think that that's a given in most of Hollywood, do you?
Well, it's frequently a given. I think that when you talk about independent films, which are the films I make, which are then taken to a major studio for part financing and for distribution, the deal is clearly an overwhelming part of the transaction. We don't often have unlimited funds. We don't often have a major star, although sometimes we do. We are dealing with tight budgets, difficult locations, usually things which are hard to explain, hard to conceptualize. So we're not focusing so much on the deal. In Hollywood, the deal is paramount because money isn't the problem. Every major studio has far more money than they have projects to spend that money on. Money is not the problem. They have money to spend on the project, on the star, on the promotion of the picture. The last problem is, where do they get the money from? The biggest problem is, how good is the deal, and can they find the right kind of project to work on? So the deal becomes far more important in Hollywood, and often the deal is done without any attention being paid to the script, without any attention being paid to the integrity of the project. It's basically, who is the star, how much is he worth, what sort of impact will he have on the marquee, can we get Arnold Schwarzenegger, can we get Sylvester Stallone, can we get whoever it is who's hot at the time, and let's not worry too much about the budget or the script right now. Let's get the deal done first. I think it is an overwhelming part of the Hollywood system, which is regrettable.
Do you pre-sell films? And if you do, I'm going to ask you to describe what pre-selling is.
Yes, I do. And pre-selling simply is taking the project which we've designed, which has a script and a cast and a budget and a director and a producer, and going to a distributor, either in the U.S. or, in many cases, individual foreign countries, and getting him to agree to put up X amount of money, which is payable to us when we deliver the film. So we've pre-sold the rights to the extent that he doesn't see the film before he buys it. He sees the project. He sees the proposal and buys it basically because he believes in the script and the talents of the filmmakers involved and that he thinks the terms are fair. And he pre-buys it and pays us once the film is finished and delivered. I then take the contract, which he signs, which is a promise to pay on delivery, and go to a bank, and the bank then lends me money against that promise. I then have the money to make the movie, and when the film is delivered, the person who signed the contract pays me. I then pay back the bank, and hopefully there's a bit of a margin. We make a profit. That's what pre-selling is.
Now, I think it's largely because of pre-selling that there's something called high concept, which is where you pre-sell a movie based on two or three lines that explains what the movie is. Give us an example of a high concept sales pitch.
Well, a high concept sales pitch, I think, can be best exemplified by taking a complicated film and then trying to reduce that film to a few words, or the story to a few words. We got involved some years ago with a wonderful film with Sean Connery called The Name of the Rose, which was based on a best-selling book by Umberto Eco. Best-selling book is probably a bit of a misnomer because it's probably the greatest unread bestseller in the history of publishing. Everyone bought it, but no one could read it. I bought it. I struggled through it. I had a terrible time reading it, but I loved it. I just found it very hard to read. Frankly, I didn't get through it the first time. I then had to go back and read it when I finally got involved with the film. But that is a very complex tale with all sorts of side tales and red herrings and philosophical conversations about Christianity and about the Inquisition and about the place of man on earth. And it's a very complex book. But when I came to sell the idea, I had to reduce all that mass of 680 pages into a 2 or 3 sentence sales pitch to Hollywood. So I said, this is a story about a murder in a medieval monastery starring Sean Connery. That was it. And on that basis, we were able to raise almost $17 million. Now, Sean's name, of course, helped somewhat, although in those days he wasn't quite as big a star as he is now. He'd been mainly known for his James Bond roles and hadn't been really all that successful in non-James Bond roles. And I'd known him for some time. I was a great admirer of him, and I thought he was a wonderful fellow to work with. He's a wonderfully friendly man and someone that you can get along with very well, although he's very demanding. And so we weren't selling Sean because he was a major star. We were selling Sean because he was a fine actor, and I felt that if he could perform the way I thought he could in this film, he'd break out of the James Bond mold and become much better known for non-James Bond roles. And as it turned out, that happened, and it was sold on the high concept basis, helped by Sean's name, but it was a concept. Murder mystery always sounds good to a buyer.
I'm interested in how you put a package together. Let's start at the beginning. When after you've bought the rights to a movie, and you're looking for a funding package, who do you approach first? Do you go, who are the financiers? I don't mean to name names, but what kinds of potential financiers do you typically approach to make a movie?
Oh, I'll name names if you like.
Sure.
First of all, we have to separate the financing into several different categories. And the first is the development phase, which is what I do myself. I put our own money, my own company's money goes into that phase. And that normally is in the range of $250,000 to a maximum of $1.5 million. And it's very, very risky investment because you're buying nothing more than an idea. Even if the idea is from a best-selling book, it's a complicated, difficult, and lengthy task to convert that idea into a screenplay and then finally to get the package together. Now, let me give you a case in point. City of Joy, which was a very, very successful book published 5 years ago, written by a man called Dominique Lapierre. Mm-hmm. And it was a story about a priest and a doctor in a slum in Calcutta, not the obvious choice for a major feature film. But it had the most extraordinarily uplifting qualities and the most moving and heart-rending scenes that when I read the book, I rang up the author and took an option on the film rights by telephone, and I paid at the time $100,000 to get that option against a final price of $350,000. So I put down, if you wish, had a down payment of $100,000. And if the film was ever made, I'd have to pay him a further $250,000. See, I've named names and given you actual figures here. I then took the idea to Roland Joffe, who I had known because he had been the director of The Killing Fields, which was a very successful film that we had done together in 1982. And Roland had, as it happened, read the book and knew the idea and was very interested in getting involved. So I had then an option on the book for which I'd paid $100,000. I then had a director who was very well known and very talented. We then searched around for a writer, and we came across Mark Medoff, who had written the screenplay for Children of a Lesser God. He'd also written the stage play and was adept at taking stories and plays and turning them into screenplays. And we then hired Mark, and we paid him a sum which I don't need to to disclose in quite as much detail, but a sum of money, which was once again on account of an additional payment which he would receive if the film was ever made. And we have then, since that time, we have spent 5 years working on the project.
Oh, so you don't have the money for it yet to...
Now we do.
Now we do.
We're actually in pre-production. We've been in pre-production now for about a week. And we start shooting in Calcutta on the 4th of February, 1991. And I bought the rights originally in September of 1986. So it's 5 years, or it'll be almost 5 years from the time we bought the rights to the time the film is actually finished.
So how do you raise the money, enough money, to start working on a movie? You try to sell the foreign rights?
Yes, I put up all the front-end money. And I put up a substantial amount of money against the future sale of the foreign rights. If you wish, I pre-buy my own foreign rights. I look at the foreign markets and I say, all right, in the case of City of Joy, which is a very, very expensive film, it's going to cost about $27 million, I think that I can sell the foreign rights in the various territories that I'm familiar with for around $15 or $16 million, which is a very high number. It's higher than most... films of this nature, because Roland Joffe is very well known in the foreign markets, and this kind of story appeals a lot in certain foreign markets, mainly France, Italy, Spain, Japan, Germany, and the UK. So I can estimate that I can probably do about $15-16 million of sales in the foreign markets. And since the film's going to cost about $27 million, I've got to raise another $10-12 million from the US. So I take the package, which consists of a finished script, and Roland Joffe as director. I'm actually producing this one myself. And I go around Hollywood and call on all the major studios, and I try and get them to put up $12 million against the U.S. rights. I get turned down by most people. That's standard. Finally, I got TriStar to put the money up. TriStar is now part of a major film company conglomerate owned by Sony. And TriStar have come along for the roughly $10 million, which I needed to fill the gap in. I don't actually raise money from private investors or from venture capital funds. I raise money really only from distributors of the film. I don't ask anyone else to get involved, because it's a very risky business and it's very hard to explain how the business works. And it makes much more sense to me to be selling film rights to people who are experienced in buying film rights and distributing films, and letting them make their own judgment about whether the film is good, bad, or indifferent. And if it succeeds, they have a profit share and they make more money on the back end. And if it fails, well, they take a write-off and they're going to be much more wary next time I come to see them. But they've been lucky with our films. Over the years, they've done very well with 6 or 7 of our films, and they haven't lost a lot on 4 or 5 others. So it's been a good relationship. But that's how the deal is put together.
Even though you work with a distributor who distributes the movies, you don't distribute them yourselves, I know that you'll be able to fill us in a little bit on how film distribution works. Most of the movie theaters now are owned by large chains, which, with the exception of repertories and art houses. How are movies distributed to chains? How is it? What's the bidding process like?
Well, it's open bidding in most states, not all states, but in most states, the film is shown in its finished form or almost finished form, and the theaters then bid on the film. They offer certain amounts of money as guarantees in certain terms. Typically, the theater owner, who is called an exhibitor, would pay to the distributor, in this case, let's say Warner Brothers, in the first week that the film is on release and being shown in the theater, the exhibitor will pay the distributor roughly 90% of the box office take after the exhibitor has paid his own overhead costs. In subsequent weeks, the percentage which the exhibitor pays over to the distributor decreases, so that he keeps more and more as the box office tends to go down. The main source of revenue for the exhibitor, for the theater owner, is in fact Coca-Cola and popcorn. He makes more money by selling Coca-Cola and popcorn than he makes on the ticket sale. The distributor, the funds which he received are used, first of all, to pay for the advertising and promotion of the film, which incidentally can sometimes exceed the cost of making the film. It's not unusual to spend $15 million to promote and advertise a $10 million movie. So the bulk of the money which is received by the distributor goes to pay the advertising and promotion of the film. The real profit comes once the film is finished its run in the theater, then it's sold into the video market. and ultimately into the pay television and the television markets. And most of the profit that you get from feature films comes in the video and the television markets and not from the box office.
The American economy doesn't seem to be doing that well. No, I mean, no matter what the figures officially show now, most Americans are pretty convinced that there's a recession going on. And there's a possible war on the horizon. I wonder how these things are affecting the financing of movies.
Well, the movie business is not totally recession-proof, but it's as close as you can get, to it. There is almost no evidence that there's a slowing down in the public's demand for good movies, and that applies to the exhibition of those movies in theaters or video sales or pay television sales or even network sales. The conventional wisdom is that when times are bad, people seek entertainment even more, so they tend to go to more movies or they tend to buy more videos. It's clear that the cost of capital, which is sometimes driven up by this sort of thing, or indeed it's clear that in certain markets they might be less inclined to take a risk because the general feeling of pessimism sets in. But the effect is not very noticeable. It's really quite marginal. And I haven't actually seen it yet, but I'm bound to see it to a certain extent, but not much.
What about the possibility of war? Are people in the movie business afraid to spend their money now?
The tragic thing about the film business is that the people who are involved in it have almost no idea what's going on outside the film business. One reason why I don't live in Hollywood, one reason why I live in London, England, and spend a lot of my time up in Canada, is because I find it so stifling and so limiting to live in an environment which is totally devoted to movies. And it's an unfortunate a reflection on the way the industry operates, that the impact of short, medium, and long-term problems is almost without any recognition. And although I pick up the paper every day and scan it anxiously for what's happening in the Middle East, and I carefully tune in on CNN and listen to NPR because it's a great source of news, I think that people who are deeply involved in the business in Hollywood just don't have time for it or don't have the interest in doing it, and their reading tends to be limited to looking at scripts and reading what's called the trades, which are daily issues of Variety or the Hollywood Reporter, which tells them what's going on in the business. It doesn't seem to have any impact whatsoever.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about movies. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been film executive Jake Eberts. His new book is called My Indecision is Final, The Spectacular Rise and Fall of Goldcrest Films, the independent studio that challenged Hollywood.